Welcome to TalkErie.com's Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast. Every day, we tackle the biggest issues that the Erie, PA region faces. Stay informed and involved as we advance the narrative of Erie. Now, here's Joel Natale.
We're very, very excited to have back on the program Dr. Howard Nadworny. He is an epidemiologist with AHN St. Vincent. Last time, when we first met you, Dr. Nadworny, you were like slowing down, planning on your, retirement. That ain't no thing right now. I mean.
No, sir. And actually, it's because I care about Erie and I care about the public health of Erie. And I thought that this was a disease that I needed to help with.
Yeah.
And so it's been rewarding to try to help, and it's been useful to keep up on what's going on, but it is certainly not retirement.
No. Before I jump into mine, are we still doing the bio bot? And what is that showing right now these days?
Actually, the wastewater from the last 2 weeks is the highest we've ever seen. 2 weeks ago was the highest ever. Last week was the second highest ever, and recognize that that's with 55% of the population vaccinated. So the primary group is the 35% who are unvaccinated and getting it. So there's a lot of COVID in Erie, more than there was last winter.
So it wouldn't, if we're fully vaxxed, we're not shedding antibodies into the wastewater, right? Just to be clear.
The vaccinated people are infected for a much shorter period of time, so overall they contribute less virus to the wastewater than unvaccinated people.
Got it. All right, here we go. Here's the question number one for Dr. Howard Nadworny. You said something on the presser that said unvaxxed people are putting other people at risk, and I want to know, are they putting me at risk as a fully vaxxed, boosted person? And I'm just wondering what my likelihood is that I'm going to end up in the hospital or die.
Well, actually, your risk, based on the St. Vincent data that I have through November, and making a dangerous assumption that you are under 70 years old, because of course this is the radio, so no one can tell.
Right.
You have a risk of being hospitalized that's about 1/6 of that for someone unvaccinated. And we only had one person under the age of 60 who was unvaccinated die. So your risk of death is dramatically lower, and your risk of hospitalization is much lower. Of course, we don't know who that's going to be who ends up in the hospital or who dies. But you're at risk of getting infected because the vaccine isn't perfect. But your risk of getting severely ill is much less, and your risk of dying is even smaller than that. So you are most likely, if you get infected, to have a cold-like illness or an allergy-like illness. You might feel really crappy for a week, that you really run down and feeling blah, but you're actually very unlikely to end up in the hospital. Now, as you get chronic conditions and people get older, the vaccine works less well, particularly if they have some sort of bone marrow disorder or cancer, or they've been on chemotherapy. Those are the people, the older and frailer and less, whose immune systems aren't working as well, who are much more likely to get hospitalized and die. And the other group that's more and more we're seeing are people who are very obese, because it turns out that COVID infects fat cells. And fat cells are immune cells as well. So they release a lot of inflammatory proteins, which is probably why they get a lot sicker.
But there's something to this inflammation thing, right? I mean, we kind of...
Inflammation is what tends to cause the people who get COVID to get severely ill. Because usually by about 14 days into the illness, it's very hard to identify any virus left. And yet these people are really sick. So their immune system and their inflammatory system kick into overdrive. Instead of settling things down, they go haywire. And that's what makes people much sicker. They clot more, their kidneys don't work as well, they get strokes. It's not the virus anymore after a couple of weeks of illness. It's really your own body's inflammation. Your Pentagon is attacking itself.
Steroids, are they an effective treatment in hospital?
Steroids help. we've been using dexamethasone for a while, and there are some blockers of inflammatory chemicals that we've been using that also are very helpful. I mean, it obviously is multiple things going on, but reducing the inflammation in the immune system has been helpful at slowing down the progression and saving lives. So that's been helpful, but that's later on.
Not to get into the weeds, but are there other conditions that are lend themselves to high amounts of inflammation that are that you can do an A-B comparison with COVID? Have you seen any of that?
The condition that I think of most is a condition called ARDS, or adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is when people have had pneumonia, they get a lot of scarring and fibrosis and inflammation in their lungs. And that often is what causes people who have pneumonia to die, is they just get so much scarring in the lung that they just can't breathe. And this reminds me of that. And I wonder if they have similar causes. And it may be that as we figure out things that might help late COVID, might also help with ARDS or vice versa.
Yeah, and ARDS sure sounds a lot like Spanish flu 100 years ago, too.
It's bad.
That's bad. All right, let's keep going here. You said on the presser that the technology is not new. Again, there's a lot of blowback about the vaccine because, hey, these are brand new vaccines. We don't know anything about them. And I've always said, well, they started working on this stuff with SARS-1, which is what, 10 plus years ago, right?
Yes, it is. And here's what most people don't realize. When you give a live virus vaccine, so it's attenuated, it's not capable of causing full infection, but it basically gives you a subclinical infection and you develop immunity. That's smallpox, measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, zoster vaccine, yellow fever vaccine. There's a lot of them that do that. And what happens is the vaccine virus infects your cell, and it makes copies of itself. So it makes DNA, it makes messenger RNA, they make proteins, the proteins are released into your tissues and your body develops an immune response and you become immune. The only difference between that and what we're giving now is instead of giving a virus to replicate and make messenger RNA, we're giving the messenger RNA itself. Okay. So when you get a live virus vaccine, and we all have because they work really well, you're making messenger RNA from that vaccine virus in your cells, just like what you're getting with the COVID vaccine. So it's not really, it's new technology in the sense that you can avoid having the whole virus, but the actual ingredient is exactly the same thing that your body's making when you get vaccinated by a live virus. So therefore, when I realized that, I also realized that the likelihood that it should be unique or cause different things was less likely. And as I said on the press conference, we've now given these vaccines to hundreds of millions of people. There are actually no vaccines that have any long-term or late side effects, because vaccines by definition are out of the system within 5 or 6 days, because once you develop immunity, that material is gone. And we've never seen long-term effects with any other vaccine, and we have not seen any long-term effects with these vaccines.
And people are bringing up, well, it gives you blood clots and this and that.
Actually, what's very interesting is the DNA vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca, have a risk of you getting blood clots. And that's true. But it turns out that COVID is about 15 to 25 times more likely to give you the same clots than the vaccine. In fact, when you get COVID, there was a study in the UK that showed that people who got COVID were 33 times as likely to get pulmonary emboli and deep vein thromboses, blood clots, than people who didn't get COVID, and they were 15 times as likely to get heart attacks and strokes in the first 2 weeks after infection. So the risk is dramatically higher with the infection. And it probably is because those two vaccines, in a sense, mimic what COVID's doing at a lower level. With the mRNA vaccines, the major concern has been myocarditis in young men, but the risk is actually virtually all of them have it mild. The risk, I was actually looking this up because I thought it would be important to find out. The risk is about 75 per million doses. So 75 people per million doses get it. But in studies of COVID, the risk of getting myocarditis in that same age group is between 450 and 1,500 per million. So
that's
it's
crazy.
6 to 16 times higher if you get COVID than if you get vaccine. So, and as I said, the all the scary about fertility, and I still hear that, has been debunked a long time ago. There have been studies looking at cross-reactive antibodies. They're not there. They've looked at effect on sperm. There's none. They've looked at effects on pregnancy. There's none. They've looked at the effect of giving it in pregnancy. There's none, other than the fact that the baby is protected when they're born. So none of, and none of that actually made sense theoretically either, but you know, the internet spreads scary stuff very quickly. So but the data shows no effect on that. And actually, there's a nurse that I work with who told me that she was living proof that vaccine did not affect fertility, because she said, I'm 38. And 2 months after we got vaccinated, I got pregnant and I was not expecting to get pregnant.
Wow.
So she says, I'm living proof that it doesn't affect fertility.
I got to ask you about, you know, some people are saying, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't get the vaccine right away because I just had COVID 2 months ago or a month ago or so. Is there still some of that waiting period with actually getting COVID after the fact?
There is good data that spacing vaccine doses further apart gives you a better boost. And we know that people who've had COVID have very good protection for at least 90 days and clearly for much longer. So what I usually tell people is wait 3 months before getting a booster, because the combination of having COVID and even a single booster gives you really the highest level of antibody protection compared to anything. So that getting infected and vaccinated, and probably getting vaccinated and then infected, probably gives you the best protection against future infection, including Omicron.
Dr. Howard Nadworny from AHN St. Vincent is our guest. This leads right into reinfections. We're starting to hear about that. Again, somebody who might have had, a mild case of the Alpha or the original variant and now gets Delta. You seeing much of that?
I haven't seen much of it. There is some. And actually, the data is primarily on people diagnosed with it, because of course there are people who don't get diagnosed. And what the studies seem to show is that if you've got a very, very mild case or you're asymptomatic, your immunity isn't as strong and doesn't last as long. But if you got clinically ill, your immunity is strong and lasts longer. However, with Omicron, this new one in South Africa, it has a dramatically higher likelihood of infecting people who've had the wild type or Alpha or Beta or Delta. And we know that because South Africa's actually had 4 major surges because they've had little vaccine. And before they saw Omicron in the Gauteng province, they actually thought they had achieved herd immunity because the number of cases had dropped way off. And then Omicron has showed up and it's actually been doubling every 3.5 days. So it's spreading really fast, and it's spreading fast among vaccinated people, which would say that previous infection is probably not as good against Omicron, even if you've had infection. And that's not a good thing. And that makes me worried for Erie, because we have a lot of people who have had neither vaccine nor infection. And so even though it's been described as mild, I don't yet know what's going to happen when it hits a purely unvaccinated population.
Do you feel that our lockdown and as we were so compliant in that March, April, May months in 2020. Is that biting us in the rear end now, Dr. Nadwarny?
I don't think it is, because, you know, if, I mean, with Delta, more than one out of every 100 adults who've been diagnosed with COVID's dead since July.
It's horrible.
So yeah, if we didn't have lockdown and we had a lot more COVID, sure, we'd have more immunity, but we'd have a lot fewer people. We'd have a lot more chronic illness. So no, but in fact, I think the biggest problem is that there's really been no consequence for people who haven't gotten vaccinated, who don't wear masks. And unless there's some sort of consequence or some sort of requirement for being vaccinated or showing that you're not likely to be infected, I think that it's going to be really hard to come out of this for a lot longer. I mean, in Europe, where they have instituted vaccine and testing requirements for going to public gatherings, they have found A, they're not having spread, and B, more people are getting vaccinated because they need to in order to go. We don't have anything like that here. And I think that unless there's a consequence for people being unvaccinated, then we're going to continue to see what we're seeing.
You said on the presser, nurses are leaving Erie. That's telling me that Erie is worse than other places?
Well, they're leaving Erie. Some of them are leaving Erie because they're burned out. And some of them are leaving Erie because with so many places being overwhelmed, they can make a lot more money being traveling nurses.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is they're saying, hey, I'm working my tail off taking care of these people. I can make more money going somewhere else. So they're leaving here to go travel. And the problem is that since we're not seeing new nurses coming into the system, we're merely shifting them around. It's making costs for everyone higher, but it's also making the manpower less.
I got to ask, and again, you know, I kind of feel like, especially everything I'm reading, that being double vaxxed and boosted is, you know, and even seeing on a serology test that my antibodies were super high. Like this last one, I was over 17. That was before the boost, right? So I'm like, why do I need to care about the unvaxxed people around me? I mean, otherwise, don't I have to live in fear of those unvaxxed people?
Well, I look at it as unvaccinated people are the primary spreaders of this virus. And the question is, do we really as a community want to decrease the spread of COVID in Erie County? Do we want to reduce the people hospitalized? Do we want to reduce the burden on the hospitals? Do we want fewer people to get sick and die? Do we want to get closer to normal behavior? If we do, then we need to address the people who are unvaccinated, who are putting us at risk. Because the people
but
who
how,
are in
how am I at risk? How am I at risk,
well,
Doc?
You personally, you may not be personally at risk.
Okay.
But your mother is probably at risk, and your father's probably at risk, and people living in nursing homes are at risk, and they're at risk from people who are unvaccinated. So if you look at it just for you, no, you could probably resume your life.
But explain why that loved one in the nursing home is still at risk. Even if they're triple vaxxed.
They're at risk because immunity is not perfect. And when you get exposed to an unvaccinated care worker who comes in with COVID, that amount of COVID can override your immunity and make you sick. And if your inflammatory system kicks in, I mean, if you have chronic illness or you've had cancer or you've had something wrong with your bone marrow, your immunity isn't going to be as good as yours or mine, having gotten all the vaccines. And we know from flu with nursing homes, if you just vaccinate the residents, it doesn't work as well as if you vaccinate the residents and all the care workers.
Right.
So you really have to create a bubble around them. And we have not done that. And so basically, older people and frailer people and people whose immune systems don't work as well are clearly at risk from people who are unvaccinated and coming in contact with them. And the unvaccinated may not even know they're infected because they often don't get very sick, but they're very contagious.
What about this concept of, oh, well, it's going to be endemic. Everybody's going to get this eventually. There's nothing I could do about it.
Well, first of all, you're wrong. There is something you can do about it. because if you get vaccinated and then you get infected, you're going to be less likely to get sick and you're going to be less likely to infect someone else. We know that that's true. So even if it's endemic, if we knew that most people were never going to be hospitalized and very few people would die, I wouldn't really care very much about it. So for example, if 95% of the population was immunized, still spreading, but very few people ever got hospitalized, I wouldn't get really paranoid about it.
Yeah.
But that's not where we're at. And in fact, remember back when we thought the vaccine was more than 90% effective, we thought we had to immunize 70%. So now with it 70% effective, we need to immunize 90%. With Omicron, the third dose, the booster, gets you back up to that range. So I mean, I think that if we want herd immunity, we need to get above 90%. And if we do, and we see mild cases with only a few people getting severely ill, I think we'd be happy with that.
Do we have any, in all of the history of public health, and I'm down to my last 30 seconds, any of the history of public health where we reached a 90% vaccination rate?
Oh, yes. Measles, mumps, German measles, pertussis, polio, absolutely. And when we did, we saw virtually no cases. And when immunity fell below 90%, we started having measles outbreaks and mumps outbreaks. So yes, it has, we've gotten there and it's worked and it makes a difference. So yes, we can get there.
I
need the time we want to.
I get a sense that even though the county executive is moving on to greener pastures, we'll have more conversations with Dr. Howard Nadworny. Thank you so, so much, sir, for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you.
All righty. So, big news yesterday coming out of Pfizer is that there might be a magic pill. And of course, this is not Jack and the Beanstalk. This is true chemistry and pharmaceuticals. But what are you hearing about these ideas of maybe new therapeutics that are online, Dr. Lombardo?
Yeah, so I think they're very interesting. It's definitely beneficial to have another tool in the toolbox, per se. You know, we already have the vaccines that focus on prevention and everything. We have the monoclonal antibodies that kind of help afterwards, after the infection has already taken place. And now we have an oral agent, which usually, whenever we have an oral agent, it's usually a bit cheaper to produce. It's easier to mass produce, can be available to more people. So it just adds another tool for us essentially to, maybe treat the disease after it's unfortunately already caused an infection. So it's just beneficial to have all these different treatment modalities, and there's not a whole lot of information just yet. The numbers are looking promising. Obviously it's early on, but hopefully things can pan out in a beneficial way for these new medications.
A lot of my listeners are acquainted with Tamiflu, all right? And mm-hmm. It makes me wonder, like, well, how would that work? Because there's so many different flu strains, right? So
right.
is it like this broad spectrum antiviral, so it's able to kind of, if it's able to hit at any pitch that's sent to it?
Yeah, so the nice thing is about antiviral medication is they usually target a portion of like the enzymatic process within the virus that stops it from replicating, essentially.
Okay.
So whenever we have all of these different variants of whether it's the COVID virus or, influenza, it has to do with these variants pretty much evade the immune system based on how they're presented. So for COVID-19, we're concerned, you've probably heard all this talk about the spike protein. That's what all the vaccines are based around. So, if the spike protein changes, if the way it presents itself changes, these vaccines are going to have a little bit of trouble with recognizing the virus and providing adequate immunity prior to infection. But once it's already there and these viruses replicate, now I'm not going to say that there's no way that this can be evaded, but a lot of times these antivirals focus more on a specific enzyme that has to do with this process of replication. And if we can stop that, we can stop the virus from worsening itself. So based on the data from, what I've seen in the literature, a lot of these, the drug manufacturers, the scientists studying this stuff do have hopeful, thoughts that, this probably will be able to combat, even not all the variants, but have a pretty good job at, taking care of these things. So the variants aren't as affected by these antiviral drugs, but just because of the mechanism of action, essentially. So hopefully things will work out well there.
Let's talk about this in terms of like a treatment plan, because all right, so you're kind of going down the road, you know, you're visiting family for the holidays, and you might have a sniffle or a little sore throat, or maybe, you know, you wake up and you have a fever. It would seem to me that, man, you would want to get a test pretty darn quick.
Yeah, for sure. These medications primarily have the highest level of efficacy early on in the disease state. So it's ideally used within, you know, 3 to 5 days of symptom onset of positive test. Because after a while, if you get too far gone, the viral load is just too high and these medications aren't, you know, it's pretty much, they're not going to harm you, but they're really not going to do much good. So we want to try to get this early on as possible is ideally where we would want this in the treatment plan.
Are you seeing that in the monoclonal antibodies as well, that you really got to jump on it?
Correct, 100%. So we want to use those ideally within 10 days of symptom onset or positive test date. The earlier, the better. Anecdotally, we usually see if these patients are caught early, the earlier we can give them these medications. They do fare better than individuals who receive it late. So it just has to do with the progression of the disease, how it works in the body. You know, so if we're trying to essentially inhibit its replication, ideally we want to do that as soon as possible. So the way I think of these new medications, these new oral medications, now they're early on, but I do kind of assimilate them in my head, at least, to the IV monoclonal antibodies with regards to timing of treatment, how they work. There's a lot of similarities. Obviously, they differ when it comes to true mechanism, but you can draw similarities between the two very easily.
It seems to me that it might be smarter to get the over-the-counter test as opposed to waiting for the, you know, the gold standard PCR test, and maybe your timing doesn't work out that way, because we don't know that, especially with Omicron, we might be getting flooded with tests, and that the backup would be in the testing system again, Doc.
Right, for sure. So these home tests are definitely super beneficial. They're awesome that they're being more and more available to the public. Now, you know, there does come some issues with regards to patient tests at home. They come to the hospital with regards to what day they actually tested positive. There's some discrepancies, but in the long scheme, the grand scheme of things, that really doesn't matter. The biggest thing is making sure that patients are aware that, okay, I do have COVID or I don't have COVID, so that they can follow the proper precautions from isolation to, you know, overall disease management. So I think that ideally, if these things get approved and things look good, you know, if a patient tests positive, they can call their primary care doctor, say, hey, you know, I've tested positive for COVID. So let's say they have a line out the door in their primary care office or can't be seen in the ED. They can just call in a prescription, and hopefully that will, you know, prevent a hospitalization and a little bit less stress on the healthcare system.
Oh, you see that might be the scenario of either a telehealth or just a call-in for the antiviral at this point.
Ideally, that would be awesome, yeah. I can't say for sure. Obviously, we don't know all of the data yet, how safe the medications are. We just need more time to look at all that kind of stuff. But it could work very similar to Tamiflu, like you said. They're in the same family with regards to being antivirals. So ideally, if the medications are safe and effective and they go through the proper channels, I could definitely see that being, you know, a benefit to the community.
Now, let's make sure that we make it clear here, though, that the oral pill is because if basically the puck slips through and you get COVID, the ideal would be to have the vaccination so that even if you did get COVID, you're not going to have a major problem with it.
Correct. Yeah. So by no means do I want any of this information to be misconstrued and that it's more efficacious than the vaccine or it's able to replace the vaccine. Those are the agents that we have the most data on. They are the safest, most efficacious, and prevention is always the best medicine, right? So even if you do end up getting COVID, which we all know can occur despite being vaccinated, I can tell you 100% just based on my practice, the patients that do better that, you know, have unfortunately been infected with COVID are the vaccinated individuals. And all these patients that we're seeing that are decompensating quickly, being intubated, being transferred to higher levels of care. They're all individuals that unfortunately, you know, were unvaccinated. And I don't want to say all, but the vast majority, the very large percentage are. So like I said before, this is just another agent that we can use to kind of assist our treatment plan. And patients that have received the vaccine, they get this medication too, very likely will have a positive outcome.
You know, it's remarkable to me. We're both old enough to remember, you know, March of 2020. So with basically all we had were the non-pharmaceutical interventions. You know, we wear a mask, wash our hands, cough into our sleeves. That's all we had. And now, almost 2 years later, we have a vaccine, we have boosters, and now it looks like we're on the cusp of having at least, it sounds like, two oral pills. Wow.
Yeah, there's one being produced by Merck currently that's available in the UK. There's some studies going on. And then we have this new medication by Pfizer. So two pretty big pharmaceutical giants working on one common cause here. And I think that's really what has produced all of these different treatment modalities so quickly, is that we have these massive groups of scientists with adequate funding working towards one common goal, you know?
Well, I think we'll have to learn more, and we'll be watching the FDA. Do you get a sense that this will first come under some emergency use authorization?
For sure. I think it'll definitely follow a process very similar to how the vaccines were rolled out, similar to how the monoclonal antibodies were rolled out. They'll likely go under an emergency use authorization first before being granted any type of like full-fledged approval.
I do want you to address something that keeps floating around the internet. You know, they've actually have a nickname for it, that it's Pfizer-mectin. Like, this has nothing to do with ivermectin, correct, Doc?
Correct. They're completely different. Ivermectin is an anti-parasitic medication that has been inadvertently used for multiple reasons for COVID-19, whether they're good or bad. It has nothing to do with that medication. So I think that's an unfortunate misnomer. But I mean, if it's efficacious and it gets people to take it, then whatever.
I guess basically, that's one way to look at it. If you don't trust Pfizer, just take it anyway, because if you think it's ivermectin. But there's a big difference between it being an antiviral and being an anti-parasite.
Correct. Not even in the same, completely non sequitur, these two.
Yeah, and again, we're not saying that it's horse paste. I mean, there are human uses for ivermectin.
Yeah, but there definitely are. You just got to make sure they're the right uses. You know, it's an approved drug for certain indications, not for this one.
Not for this one. All righty. Anything else that you think we should know as we go into the holidays? Again, this is probably a good time to not let your guard down on those non-pharmaceutical interventions.
Right, for sure. We should be following all of those the best as possible. You know, proper hygiene, mask whenever you're in large areas or, you know, in close contact with others that are of high risk. You know, if you can get vaccinated, I strongly recommend it. If it's time for your booster, strongly recommend it as well, especially going into the holidays. We've got the flu coming back around because of the temperature changes. It just happens to be that season as well. So I would just say, you know, do everything that you can to make sure that you and people around you remain healthy.
And it's important for younger folks too, even though this is a deadly disease if you're 70 plus, if you're half that age, it's still real. I mean, we've seen people die at 35.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen people die even younger, unfortunately. You know, the vast majority of young individuals probably will be totally fine, but it doesn't mean that they can't transmit it to somebody else. And it's just something that I wouldn't want to roll the dice with if I had the choice. You know what I mean? So
we'll leave it there. Dr. Nick Lombardo from Mill Creek Community Hospital, LECOM Health. Thanks so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast from TalkErie.com. Subscribe to our show on your favorite podcatcher and get involved by emailing joel@TalkErie.com.